Okay, tonight we're going to do where Jesus feeds the 5,000. Very familiar story. We've heard it since we was little kids. But as always, we want to look at the story in its context, and then we want to look at the story and say, what can we learn about it today in our relationship with God? Stories are great, but we must be getting a meaning out of it. So let's start with the first two verses. Somebody read from John 6, verse 1 and 2, please.
After this, Jesus crossed over the Sea of Galilee, also known as the Sea of Tiberias, and a huge crowd, many of them pilgrims, on their way to Jerusalem for the annual Passover celebration, were following him wherever he went to watch him heal the sick. Mine doesn't end at 5. I can't tell when...
Yeah, you're reading the... good news. That's it. Did good. That's it. Now, so far, the first five chapters of John have been kind of a continuous story where he went to the wedding feast at Cana and he did the miracles after his baptism. Now, when we get to chapter 6, last week we left off where he healed the man there that was by the pool of Bethesda. This one now in chapter 6, we've probably skipped a year in Christ's ministry. We know this by the four Gospels of looking at the different times that Jesus observed the Passover feast. So a Passover feast is coming up. That's why there was a tremendous crowd. That's why they had over 5,000 people there to hear him. So most commentators think that this is about a year after what happened when he healed the lame man there at the pool on the Sabbath. So it says, after these times, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. We can take that he had been preaching and that he had been healing. And as always, part of Christ, who was human, he got tired. And so he was going to take his disciples and go up into the mountains and spend some time alone in prayer and alone with the disciples. Remember, part of his mission in his 3.5 years of his ministry was to prepare his disciples and to teach them what was going to happen towards the end of his ministry, and also prepare them for their own ministry. He gets in a boat and he sails across the sea, and that was about 4 miles. But the people saw him as he got into the boat, and as he was sailing across, they probably figured out where he was going. And so the great crowd that followed him was about 9 miles of walking to go around, all the way around that sea and come to the other side. Now, I don't know how fast people walk. I guess 2 miles an hour, is that, you know, how fast does a crowd walk? But anyway, they move fairly quickly. But it took them quite a few hours to get there. Shows two things. Number one is they certainly wanted to hear what he said and what he would do. And second of all, this certainly will make more sense in just a little bit of why they would be hungry. So they had traveled about 9 miles, sat down and talked to him. Now somebody read 3 and 4.
Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him...
Okay, let's stop there. So here Jesus wanted to be by himself. He wanted to be by the disciples. He thought that was absolutely important. But as always, when the Master looked at the multitude, when he saw people that were looking after him or wanting something from him, he always responded. So he, from all accounts, he was up high in the mountains. There was a grassy field. The people were there. And Jesus came down to see the people, to be among them. Now let's pick up the story. Verse 6. Or we'll finish with 5.
He said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do.
Okay. So, obviously, these people had come. They were excited to see Jesus. They were not overly prepared. It's thought that probably some of them had food, but perhaps they didn't want to share it with anybody. I mean, if you've got two Whataburgers and there's 5,000 people, you might not want to share that Whataburger very, very often. Now, Jesus recognized somewhere in his preaching and his teaching that these people were hungry and needed to be fed. So he says to Philip, what did he say to Philip?
Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?
Now, what do you think he asked Philip for? Does anybody know? Very good. He lived there. So obviously, he would say, okay, you're from Grand Prairie. Where's a store? Where's some that we can go buy some groceries for these people? Now, the point I want to ask, it says that he did that to test Philip. Why did he ask that question? It says that Jesus already knew what he was going to do. Why did he ask that of Philip? Okay. On the right track. Well, who else? What other comments? Input. Why did he ask him, well, Philip, where can we go buy some bread? Okay.
Yes, with the life they were going to be living, you needed to learn that you can't survive without money. You need to think outside of human methods of survival.
Yeah. It's a method of teaching. In teaching salespeople, in a presentation, this is a principle of selling. If I state something, it could be or couldn't be. If you state something, what is it? It's a fact. So in selling 101, you can sit there and tell your prospect facts, or you can ask questions, and if he gives you answers that's correct, then it's a fact. This is a method that Jesus uses a lot of times. He asks questions. Why? Not because he's interested in the answer. Because here he says he already knows what's going to happen. But can you imagine when the disciples, when he said that question, he wanted their response. Because he wanted their input to understand exactly a miracle that he was going to perform. So he says to Philip, says, where are we to get bread so that these may eat? Says he was saying that just to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Somebody read verse 7.
Philip answered him, 8 months wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite.
Okay, what version is that?
International.
International. It says 8 months?
Right.
Yeah. Philip says, in the King James, he uses, does he use? I don't have King James. Does anybody else have anything else? Denarius or denarii. Yeah. That was about a day's wages. So he said that they would take over 200 denarii, wouldn't even feed these people. So that is equal to about 6 to 8 months of wages. Think the disciples had this kind of money? No. So that's what Philip is saying. How can we do that? Takes 8 months worth of work, 6 to 8 months for every work to receive money to go buy some so they can have a little bit of bread. All right, verse 8.
One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes, but what are these for so many people?
Okay. What do you think Andrew's thinking as this goes through his head?
I think he thought he could do something or he wouldn't have brought it up.
Okay. What else?
He was probably aware of the turning the water to wine in Cana.
Okay. Then why did he say there are so many people?
Yeah. What good is it with this one?
Yeah. What do you actually do you think he was offering? He thought a miracle was coming. He was wondering if a miracle was coming. Or do you think he was just making an observation?
I think that he was thinking it could happen, but he didn't want to look stupid, so he added that.
Okay. It's an interesting one. I hadn't thought about that. Could be. Brought five barley loaves. Why does, remember John is writing this. Why did he use, why didn't he just say five loaves of bread? Why five barley? It was the bread of the poor. The only time that barley loaves was used in the sacrificial system was when a person who committed adultery would present a sacrifice at the temple. Everything else was used of wheat, which was the best. But barley was always used for this type of sacrifice simply because barley was next to fodder. F-O-D-D-E-R, is that fodder? Okay. That they fed to the beasts, and it was considered by the Jewish that if you committed adultery, that you were just a person of the beasts. And so that was the only time in the sacrificial that you used barley. It was absolutely the bread of the poor. Poorest of the poor.
It doesn't have a good gluten content, so it doesn't make good bread.
Yeah. So this was not good bread. How big do you think the fish were? We do know, by the way.
Small?
What small? Who knows what sardines are? The fish were about the size of sardines. So yeah, they were super small. The reason being is, if you remember back in those days, they had no way of keeping fish. So anything that was carried or that you had for picnic or you're going to carry around had to be very, very small. So it's generally thought it was probably... And if you don't know what sardines are, they're about that big and they stink. I don't know if this fish stunk, but it was about that big. So why the boy had it with him, nobody knows. I have no concept. But anyway, so Andrew says, well, there's a little boy here. He's got five loaves of pitiful bread. He has two fishes. But man, how are you going to feed this bunch?
What does that say about Andrew?
We're going to come to that later.
Okay.
Because that's the meaning of the story. If we don't understand, well, let me get to my end. And we'll go through it. Good question, Leroy, because that's part one of two conclusions. So he took the poorest of bread, the smallest of fish, and then he tells them to set down. Get them organized. It's generally thought that the men were separated from the women and the children. There were 5,000 men, so we don't know how many. Actually, he fed. It could have been, if every man had a woman and a child, that would have been 15,000. So we don't know.
Moffat's translation says, "Let lie down."
Okay.
Why would they say lie down rather than sit down?
Okay.
5,000 people lay down.
If you remember, when they ate, they always sort of...
It was kind of lounging.
Yeah, lounge. You know, they didn't have chairs.
Yeah.
So they just sort of spread it out on the imagine.
The word in the Greek means recline. Yeah. So they lie down because they kind of, remember even at the Lord's Supper, we see them where they're kind of sitting around a table. But remember, one of them had the disciples had his head on Jesus' breast, so they kind of reclined up against each other. So yeah, they actually kind of reclined, got very comfortable. From all accounts, this was thick grass, a grassy knoll, and very thick. So very relaxed. He gets them relaxed. All right, gives thanks. Distributes to show that everybody got full. Well, see, somebody read 12.
When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over, let nothing be wasted."
Okay. They were full, filled. Greek is the word for stored up. So they certainly got their money worth. They certainly got filled. And they had 12 baskets left over. Why do you think the 12 baskets, what do you think happened to that food?
Probably took it on their way home.
Who took it on their way home?
It was hard to take. Takeout boxes.
Who do you think took the food home?
The people who had walked 9 miles.
12.
Well, one of the disciples.
Yeah, each one of the disciples took them. Reason being is on long journeys, which the disciples went on long journeys, it's generally thought that the Greek word is a basket. The basket was horn-shaped. And whenever you traveled, you carried some hay and you carried a little basket. Hay was for you to sleep on, and the basket was where you would put your food down in there and keep it in to eat. And so it's generally thought that 12 baskets, 12 apostles, would certainly make sense, because 12 baskets for 15,000 people wouldn't do anything for anybody.
I was corrupted by the Bible story. They show big baskets.
Yeah.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. That's correct. It didn't quite work. It's kind of a horn shape that you would carry over your shoulder. And then you would stop and eat and stop and eat. So, don't take that as a little fact, but it certainly, most commentators would say 12 baskets, 12 disciples. Just kind of makes sense.
12 disciples had food that Jesus gave.
They shared. Judas probably sold it to Jesus. So they gathered them up, filled their baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. All right, let's stop there for a while. Now let's kind of analyze. First of all, wouldn't this have been a nice place to have preached a health message? Little gluten burger? What's important in this story? It's certainly a story we've heard. It certainly shows that Jesus could perform a miracle. Why did he do it? What's important about it? How did it affect them? And what do we learn out of this whole story? Because Jesus is not going to come down and, I don't think, perform a miracle of that sort for us.
When people are hungry, they're not going to listen to anything. They're talking about food.
Okay. So how would you put that of the importance of in our time?
Well, when we can't be like some churches when we bring food to the outreach centers. They have to listen to a half-hour sermon before they can eat. I've seen this in some places where they that's wrong.
Okay. Yes?
I was reading something about this little story recently. And Jesus knows what he's going to do.
He can see in the future, and he knows. Otherwise, why was the little boy there and willing to give up his bread and fish? And when he had big crowds of people around him, his miracles were such that they couldn't have been an accidental or an, you know, something happening like that. When he spoke to people, he said, "I am, I am." Mm-hmm. And so this was just one more illustration of what he was or who he was.
Okay.
Well, don't you think he knew what would happen to the disciples if they would be go out preaching the word by themselves? Some of them took their wives. And there would be times when they'd be hungry. And they would remember this, that they wanted to know that their food would be provided, maybe.
Okay.
Even if it took a miracle, it would happen. Okay. Someone would provide it for them, just about, like the little boy was just a bystander.
Okay. So you think it helped increase the disciples' faith?
Right.
Okay, yes.
Verse 14 says, "When therefore the people saw the sign..."
Yeah, we're going to come to that one. Hold that one.
Okay.
Very good. On the right track.
I don't know what all it said to those people at that particular moment, but as we study it today, we're aware that food is one of the basic human psychological needs. Eating, shelter, those sort of things. And it is a point that God does care about those essential needs also.
Okay.
Well, I can't hear what everybody said. I may repeat whatever somebody else has said. But first off, I see Jesus, he came to this earth for a particular purpose, and that is to tell the people what the Father's like. And the way he lived, the things he did, he just said not long ago that the Father, I and the Father are just alike. Mm-hmm. You see me, you see the Father. So here he has a bunch of people. Now we've already said it took them a while to get there. Let's say they started out at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning and walking 10 miles. When that crowd of people got over to him, it had to be 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Jesus is well aware that they had not had anything to eat all day long. And he's saying, God is the provider. He provides for your needs. And this is the way he does it. So I think that he was telling something about the Father, the way that he provided for them to eat, because that was his compassion, to knew that the people had to be hungry. Now, if they were over on this side of the island, they lived from somewhere else, they had to go back. And he could not send them back to the other side of the tent with nothing to eat all day long.
Okay. All right. So, I stumbled over this word, but I think I could just pray. So, did he have an ulterior motive for breaking the barley loaves and the two little sardine-like fish? She says, to increase the disciples' faith, which I agree with that, by the way. She says, as we're going to come, the people see the signs. We'll come to that in a second. Did he have an ulterior motive for doing this?
He used opportunities to do what he did.
Okay. What do you think motivated him to do it? Pardon? Okay. What other input?
Well, he can have more than one motive for doing the same thing. It can be
Okay.
Serve several.
Certainly. One of them had to be the disciples. That's why he made the point of saying to Philip, hey, where can we go find some food? He wanted to drive that. That's exactly correct. That was one of the reasons. What other reasons? Compassion. What do you mean by compassion? Yes.
Well, he often said he was the bread of life. So. Yeah.
That's who he is.
Right.
See, the beauty, part of the beauty of the story is that is who he is. He healed the sick because that's who he was. He healed 10 lepers. And 9 of them didn't even think enough to even thank him. But he didn't care. He cared, but you know what I'm saying. He didn't care. He still healed them.
You know, also, that food is the very necessity of life. And that he provided the very basics and necessity of life. That they could look at him on, this is who we can trust. He was the very basic needs in life.
Absolutely. Why didn't he really, really do a theatrical thing and really give them a feast?
He gives you what you need.
Man, what did you think? T-bone steak, baked potato, key lime pie.
He had 1,006 people on his hands.
Yeah. See? He wasn't after a theatrical presentation. He had a congregation that was hungry. He fed those that were hungry spiritually, he fed them. And those that were physically hungry, he fed him. That's who he is. He gave them the poorest of the poor. But John makes a very big point of saying they were all full. Full to satisfaction. What do we learn? This is what Leroy brought up. Now we're going to get to what I think the crux of the story is. Let's look at it before I jump into it. What does the story mean to you today? We touched on this a little bit, but now let's get down to the story. What does it mean to you today? If you're hungry, Christ is going to give you some food. So what's the practical?
It tells me that Christ cares about my ordinary needs.
Okay.
As much as he cares about my spiritual needs.
Okay. Anybody else, Alma?
Back. I'm sorry.
Well, the barley loaf and the little fishes was probably a well-known or well-used thing with that crowd. That's what they ate every day. I mean, if I'm really hungry and somebody gives me a bowl of beans and a piece of bread, that will sustain my life very well. I don't need a banquet.
Okay. Absolutely. Huh? What else do you learn today? Let's look at Andrew. Andrew is a hero in this story. Why? What did he do that is so outstanding? Told who?
Christ.
How come Andrew didn't solve the problem?
Well, maybe you can consider he did since he found the boy with the food.
Okay.
And brought him to Christ.
What other input? And did what?
Brought him to Christ.
That's why he's a hero.
most of our accounts of Andrew, seems like Andrew is always out among the people. He's the fellow that goes out and brings somebody in to see Christ. When Disciples was his first form, he was the guy that goes out and gets me, hey, come see. And I can picture Andrew out among this crowd, just nothing else, visiting, talking with whoever it might be. And when you're out among the people, you see what is around. Mm-hmm. And I imagine he just registered on him, this little boy, he has a lunch, you know, everybody else, nobody has anything. That's a smart kid, whether I got it or not. And so, it was just natural for Andrew.
Mm-hmm. See, to me, this is the most important, one of the most important parts of the story. That Jesus could do miracles is nice. That's nice to know. I've seen miracles that he's done, but they certainly have been a very subtle one-on-one type of miracles. Andrew saw a possibility, and he brought it to Christ. What lessons can we learn from that? Bring ourselves to Christ? Absolutely. What other lessons?
I think he brought that boy to Christ.
Okay.
I don't think he went out and took the boy's lunch and brought it in. Faced Christ himself.
How does that, what do we learn from that? Remember, if we don't take and apply to our lives, they're just nice stories. How can we apply that to our life? What would that mean to us? He found a boy. He brought it to Christ. What can we learn from that?
Have faith that Christ will take care of our problems.
Okay. What problems? What problems?
Well, this was a boy. And he didn't look, sure, too promising.
We're going to come to the boy in a second. We're working on Andrew right now. Because the second hero in the story is the boy. And we'll look at why. You said bring to Christ. And what do we bring to Christ?
Just what we have.
Ourselves.
Didn't wait for it.
Ourselves, but Andrew did not bring himself to Christ. He brought a boy with some fishes to Christ. Not sure that Andrew believed that.
I think he did, or he wouldn't have brought him.
Okay.
What I remember about reading about Andrew is he never really solved the problem. He'd see something, he'd take it to someone else.
Right.
And I think that's what it was. He didn't solve the problem. He didn't say, we can turn this into 5,000, whatever. He took it, and can you solve the problem? And I think that's the way we are. We can't see how to solve the problem. That we take Christ,
you know, Christ himself.
And I think that's what we need to do, is follow that example.
Okay. Do we follow that example?
He introduced the boy to Christ. And we, you know, that's all we can do with anybody else, is bring them and try to show them who Christ is.
Is that, that sounds really nice. Do we do that? What do with people that have five little loaves and two little fishes? What do we do spiritually for them?
We want to be sure they're not catfish, first thing. Be sure that the loaves are not made with hog lard.
Do you see why Andrew's a hero? He took what was available He brought it and put it in. You can go sit by your husband. Okay. He took what was available and he took it to Christ and put it in his hands to solve the problem. What do we do when it comes to witnessing?
We like to be the judge. Like Ben and talked about the judge and the jury. We like to be the judge. And we're not the judge.
Nope. That's exactly right.
You want to try to convert them instead of letting Christ convert.
Absolutely correct. Andrew saw a little boy, five little loaves, two little fishes. Whether he thought Jesus was going to make a miracle or not, don't know. It doesn't make any difference if he did or he didn't. He took them to the source of power.
I think our tendency as humans is to want to fix the problem.
Absolutely. We would have, some of us would have taken a slide rule out and measured them fish in the deal and tried to calculate what can we do with it or whatever. But our job in witnessing is not try to figure out how to dissect five little loaves and two little fishes and get people straight or non-straight or decide who eats or not eats or decide who shares or not shares. Our job as an Andrew is to bring them to Christ.
In the same line, kind of what Ken was saying, was that how can we do that ourselves with our own problems? That we, you know, I'm going to solve this myself, I'm going to take care of it, and that's the very, very, very last resort that we take to Christ.
Yeah, so.
Instead of Andrew just automatically taking Christ to start.
Absolutely.
But can you imagine being in that situation, knowing the circumstances, take you, Jesus, you can multiply these fish for all these folks. I mean, that would be very easy. Go and tell Jesus to do that. So you say, here, and let Jesus do what he wants to.
That's exactly right.
I mentioned this to your wife, and last Sabbath we had these people over that had Friday night services, and they had baptized 20 people. And so I asked him, well, what do you discuss when you're there? Well, he said, we don't discuss church doctrine. I thought that was interesting. That kind of brings up what you're saying. You let the Holy Spirit work on them and you make the friends and love them into the church.
Yeah. Look. Go ahead, sorry.
They're right there by the lake. The best, you know, just come across the lake. And we know different stories. Christ had the disciples just go cast a net, pull in all the fishes that they wanted. But he could have done that just as easy at that time and brought in big fishes for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose not to do that. In this case, he chose to use something that the little boy had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The lesson that we need to learn, and the reason that Andrew is, when people are inquiring, when people have problems, when people are looking, our job is not to correct the path that they're on. Our job is to bring them to Christ. I don't know about you all. I've seen people in the past, when I was in a legalistic mode of life, that I would sit there and actually wonder, you know, this is a nice family, they're Christian, seem to have a good relationship with God. I wondered if I introduced them to the Sabbath, would it just mess their life up? Do you understand what I'm saying? Is this real? See? Well, if just using the Sabbath. If the Sabbath is what I think is the cornerstone or the central part of being saved, then I have a right to wonder that. But if Christ is the central part of salvation, let Him take care of it. And that's the lesson I think we learned from Andrew. Here it is. Best I can do. Not sure what you're going to do with it, Lord. And God says, as He always does, thank you, I know exactly what to do. What's your comments? Okay. Yes.
This kind of ties in with a little bit, but not totally. I was going through some books today, and I pulled one off the shelf and almost brought it to you, not bad, you know, as a joke. Because I'm taking it out of my collection because I can remember through various churches where I've been on the church board where I use this book along with a lot of the board members as a hammer called Counsels to the Church, I think it is, or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a compilation that the church put out, and you use this as a guide. And I got to thinking about it today, and I said, you know, this isn't how we should deal with people. We should take the "what would Jesus do" attitude in these situations, because everything is different. You can't use a set rule of rules with every individual. There's different ways to handle things.
Yeah, compilations, they were made to be a benefit that they thought, but when you look at some of the compilations, they're taken out of context, you read paragraphs here and there, and I think in a long term they did a misjustice by doing that. Messages to young people, you know, that should just be not read very often. Because it's just hammer here, hammer there, hammer here. Context. Have to look at things in context. They were not written one paragraph at a time. They were written in context of lots of things. And that's the problem we have with compilations.
Well, they weren't actually books that she wrote.
No.
They were books that were put together after the fact. Mm-hmm. So that we could keep the Illinois estates with royalties, I think.
Well, I wouldn't.
Letters that she had written.
Yeah, you know, you just take a piece. So when you sit down and read them, there is no love in there. You read The Desire of Ages, and you come away with a picture of the most magnificent picture, in my opinion, outside of the Bible, on the life of Christ. But you read other books where it just picks and what you can do or not do on the Sabbath and things like that, and there's no love in that. That's not our job. That's what Andrew was trying to teach us in the story. Bring people to Christ and let Christ work with them. He's given us that promise that He would do what He could do. It's His job to transform the heart, not ours. Okay. How's a little boy fit into all this? From all accounts, this was a young child. I mean, we're not looking at a teenager and old man. How he got there, don't know. Who he's with, don't know. What we learned from him.
You know, this, as you said at the beginning, these were travelers going to Jerusalem. That could have been his food for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
And he willingly gave up his food.
Okay. What?
But if these were travelers going to Jerusalem, why didn't the people have any food? Why did just one little boy have food?
It
seems like all the adults would have food as well.
Don't know that answer. That's why I said some of them might have had, but they didn't want to share. What we learned from the little boy, how does that affect us today? Okay. Okay. What else?
I don't know. Again, I don't hear what's being said, but I just wonder if the little boy, part of it was he was willing to serve. He was willing to be used.
Okay.
For whatever means that he had.
Okay.
He could have said, "No, it's mine," but he was willing to be used.
All right, let's look at it from a different viewpoint. Give me the reasons why the little boy should not have given him the 5 loaves and the 2 little fishes.
Well, still quite a ways to Jerusalem, for one thing. Apparently his mother was taking care of him while she gave him some smoked fish and some bread before he left home or something. Maybe she was alone, who knows. But it was still a ways to Jerusalem.
Yeah. So, number one reason why he shouldn't have done that was he's putting himself at risk. What's the other reasons? Did he have enough to solve the problem?
He could have been ridiculed. You know, what a simple little boy. You know, 5 loaves for 5,000 people.
Yeah. What an idiot. What did he have to offer?
Did the little boy just happen to be?
Could be, couldn't be. What did he have to offer? He had no solution for the problem.
But he offered what he had.
Okay. Now, how do we apply that to our lives today? Yes.
Little children trust older adults and so forth. And Jesus attracted small children to himself. And they are willing to give you anything.
Okay.
They just, that's their nature. I mean, why else should we become like little children? And I think that's the attitude we should have, not crawl around on the floor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
What this means to me is if I give what I have to Jesus, he can do incredible things with it.
Absolutely. That is the point. Remember this statement. Little in the hands of God is much. How often have we said or we've heard said, I have no talents. I have nothing to offer. I can't give. I mean, just stop back and think. Andrew brought a boy with 5 and 2, and on the outlook, anybody had the right to say, what in the world do you think this 5 loaves and 2 fish are going to feed 10 to 15,000 people? But little in the hands of God is much. And so it is with our witnessing, our talents, our gifts, what we have to offer. God has never asked us to only be the talented or the rich or whatever. He's asked each one of us to give what we have. And that's what that boy gave. And he was able to take that and turn that in to where everybody was full. An old story is told, whether it's true or not, who knows. An old German teacher used to come into his classroom. He would take his hat off and he would bow to his students. And one day somebody asked him, well, why in the world do you do that? There's just a bunch of boys. Why do you do that? And he said, you never know when one of these boys might become great. And as the story goes, one of his students was Martin Luther. So we never know what we have that we can put into the hands of God that can be a blessing to lots and lots of people. So the lesson to learn from this story is, my opinion, is not that Jesus can do great miracles, not wonderfully that he fed a bunch of people. He certainly had compassion on them because that is who he is. But he had a disciple who had sense enough to take a solution and put it into the hands of Christ. And he had a little boy who had little, put it in his hands that he could make much. And I think those are the two principles that we ought to walk away with this story in our life. Come to Christ ourselves. Bring people to Christ. Don't try to win arguments. Don't try to point out differences. Boy, I learned a long time ago how ill that I did to church and myself. Well, what do Seventh-day Adventists believe? Well, we're Protestants, but we differ. Used to do that. What a shame. I didn't do it in selling. So when somebody asks, what about Seventh-day Adventists? Tell them about the beauty of God. The beauty of His character. Tell them what we have in common is the goodness of God. The second thing, no matter what we have in our life, God is yearning, God is pleading, God rejoices when we bring that little and put it in His hands. Because of that, He can do much. Any comments? Yes?
On this story, most of us in the business world, most of our value is how well we're able to solve problems. Mm-hmm. When you're able to solve problems, the higher you go. And what happened, what businessman would have said, okay, here are five barley loaves, solve the problem? Never. So I think that's what it is. We've got whatever we have, we've got to take that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I was reading Oswald Chambers again tonight while I just sat there paging through some things. Come across the statement that just struck home. Being saved is the easiest thing there is. God does all the work. I mean, think about that. That's words, but what a principle. Being saved is, I always thought salvation was the hardest thing in the world to get. Being saved is the easiest thing to do. God does all the work. Now, Jesus just got through doing this. The disciples see a great miracle. The 10 to 15,000 are fed. Sounds like it's a great day. Somebody read the next couple of verses.
When therefore the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, this is of a truth the prophet who is to come into the world. Jesus therefore perceived that they were intending to come and take him by force, to make him the king, therefore. Or withdrew again to the mountains
by
himself alone.
Okay. How successful was all of this? What did the people get out of this great display?
Here's how they can feed us. Take care of our welfare system. Provide
our materialism.
What they really said was, thank goodness for the Democratic Party. Get back at Nate for a couple of months ago. What they really said, how did it affect them? What were they interested in?
What did it do for them?
Yeah. This is the prophet. What's the fifth book of the Bible? In that book, it had been foretold that the Messiah would come and he would feed and he would heal and he would take care of the sick. They said, this is the prophet whom we've read about, we've heard about. This is him. And what did they want out of this man?
Get rid of the Romans, earthly king.
Yeah. The Greek says that it means that they literally would have seized him, carried him back to Jerusalem, would have said, "This is our king," and go right into rebellion against the Roman Empire. This was what they were looking for. After all, if we have an army and they're hungry, what's going to happen? If we get our arm cut off, if we get killed,
bring us back alive.
Let's go get those Romans. Pardon? That's right. We have found what we're looking for. What do you think of people like that?
That was everybody in Israel that believed in him. They earned the kingdom.
Okay. What do you think of people who looked at it and said, "Man, look how this affects me and what I can get out of that"? What do you think of people like that? Who said human? Okay. What else? Do we ever do that? You know, every once in a while I think about what I pray for. And guess what I find myself praying for? Pardon? Yeah. Help me in my work. Help me here. Take care of this kid. Take care of that one. Help my crazy granddaughter.
There's nothing wrong with that.
If that's all that you pray for?
Well, no. But I think God expects us to ask for
Didn't receive because you didn't ask.
Okay, I believe in that too, James.
It's certainly not wrong to pray for our children.
I believe that.
But we spend our whole life, so what's in it for me?
Yes. See, the question is, when you see Jesus, do you see Him as an answer to all of your problems, or do you see Jesus who is the answer to lead you where you need to go?
Couldn't be both.
Good question. What's the answer?
Well, you may lead to an opposite direction than you think.
Trust God. And I haven't always been faithful to God, but He's always been faithful to me.
Absolutely.
I never could understand why.
Yeah. So, I think, Nate, and we're along the same lines, these people saw an absolute beautiful picture of God from compassion, from preaching. We don't know what He preached that day. Obviously, John didn't think it was very important. To meeting their needs, feeding him, food left over, lessons for the disciples, and the only thing they got out of it is this: what it can do for me is to liberate us from the Romans and He can be a king, and it's what's in it for me. That's what I'm saying. If we're not careful, when God comes along, do we pray, "God, I want to do Your will," or, "God, here's my lists, and will You meet my needs my way?" And I think there's a danger in that. We sometimes do that. I'm sure that there were people in that great multitude that remembered this. I'm sure that at the crucifixion, when they heard of the resurrection, that maybe these people, some of them connected the dots. But we must remember the disciples, day in and day out, one of the things I'm totally amazed of, after 3.5 years, what were they arguing about on Thursday night before Christ went to the cross on Friday? Who's going to be the greatest? They had no clue.
At the crucifixion, they, for the most part, they split.
They all ran. John stayed there. Yeah. They had, how could that be in 3.5 years? How can that be? But they had no clue. And that's what I think we need to learn, is that our prayer life, we say to the Jews, well, what a bunch of crazy people. Here they, all they wanted was to be king and get away from the Romans. But what's our life is? Is all we're wanting is God to be, as I said to somebody in Sabbath school here a while back that kind of got on my nerves, God is not an answer man. See? And sometimes we tend to look at that as God, you know, just we want God to be an answer man. That's what the Jews wanted. God has been good to all of us. But we almost always ask for Him to lead. Always ask Him to bless, and here's our wants, but we have to leave it in His hands. That is the answer. So that's the story of the 5,000. I hope that we all look at it and see what it can do for us. Because after all, that's why John put that story in there. Before we close, are there any other comments or questions? Yes, James.
Well, you know, I invited a friend to come. I'm not trying to focus on me, but I invited a friend to come. And he came. And, you know, I don't know where to go from now, from there. And, you know, if you leave it in God's hands.
Well, I think that's a good question. That's a very practical question. I made a statement one time, and I won't back down off of it, but we had somebody that was here, and they said, I'd like for you to pray for my sister because she's showing interest in going to Joel Osteen's church. And my answer was, maybe that's where God wants her.
So He wants you to pray that she not go there?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who the person is, so I don't
know the connection. So, well, what the emphasis, well, if she goes there, she's not going to find God. If she comes to our church, she'll find God. See? Who's to say that? I mean, we must look at our own history. There was a time when everybody prayed that they wanted medical college, and they felt in, and the deal was between Loma Linda, California, and Washington, and so they prayed, and they felt God led them to Colorado, and so they moved to Colorado, and then they finally figured out they were supposed to be back in California. God does not always take us from A to B to C to D.
Sometimes, too, people, and this always gets me when you're in a church setting, and they make some stupid decision, and they say, well, God must have not wanted it. Well, come on.
Oh. In this particular case, there was a faction of the church. They were held strong to go to Colorado. It was creating a rift. So they went to Colorado, and everybody agreed, this ain't where we're supposed to be. So maybe that's the way God works it out. So who's to say that God's going to take you to A, B, C? Don't know that. We do know one thing. He has promised He will do everything in His power to save every single human being. And that's why I have to trust Him.
Well, I think it's been hard for the people in the church to accept what he really said, that there's other people in other churches that belong to him. Right. Because we get this self-righteous mode that thinks we've got the truth.
See, truth is Jesus Christ. Truth is not the Sabbath. Truth is not eating pork. Truth is Jesus Christ. And the greatest example, and then we're going to close, was William Miller. Ellen White says the angels of heaven stand over the grave of William Miller until the resurrection day. And guess what the last thing he rejected was? Seventh-day Sabbath. Now, when I come across that, I was fairly young. Man, I had to ponder that for a long time. See? But he knew truth. That's Jesus Christ. Now, I can't explain it. I'm sure when Jesus gets William Miller over into instructional league in heaven, that William Miller will say, how did I miss that? Father in heaven, you're a good God. You have many avenues to you because you work fervently to save every human being that will listen to you. We hold you to that, and we're so thankful because I fit into that category of every human being. And thank you for what you've done in my life. In Jesus' name, amen.